We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 26, Learning Defense Against the Dark Arts. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. John Nelson about how the Harry Potter series teaches us to defend ourselves against the dark arts. I'm Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competence at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we're having a lesson in defense against the dark arts, which feels very timely, although I think I've been saying that for the last several years.
Yes, true. We're hoping it won't be timely soon.
Oh, that would be nice. It's an interesting class at Hogwarts because you're not teaching the dark arts themselves, ostensibly. Rather, right. You're teaching the defense against the dark arts. And right. I am not even sure if that's really possible. Maybe yeah. I'm with, you know, Mad-Eye Moody, but really Barty Crouch Jr. about, you know, teaching, you know, sometimes you're teaching dark arts at the same time.
Yeah. Right.
It's supposed to set off Hogwarts, I think, from other schools like Durmstrang, where mm-hmm. they are teaching dark arts, you know, and I wonder, Professor Karkaroff, is that wise? Is it wise to teach teenagers the dark arts?
I'm not sending my kid there.
So, Emily, do you think there are, in the Muggle world, subjects that are too dangerous to be teaching students? What do you think?
I'm going to have to give a no to that. Although, I don't know. You know, I mean, obviously there's some exceptions, but, you know, most people can find that on the internet these days. So, you know, I mean, I think that there are subjects certainly that are not constructive, you know, and those probably, you know, we would want to avoid. But I think for most subjects, I think the key is just to have that sort of a collaborative relationship with the students and the parents of the students and the caregivers of the students so that, you know, the education is kind of something that wraps around them and that certain points of it, you know, if they're problematic, then all parties are aware of what's, you know, being instructed and, you know, nuances can be, you know, pointed out and, you know, so I don't know. I wanted to say, oh yeah, certainly. I would not want my kid to know how to make, you know, bombs and things like, but I mean, you know, like it seems dangerous to go down that road, you know, and say, what do you think? What are the subjects that I'm missing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think about that too. But as you say, like they can find out how to do that.
Yeah.
Like they're better at that stuff than I am.
Right.
The Googling with the Google machine. And you know, this, when you teach history, you basically have to deal with this question all the time. And I teach people who will go into public schools and teach history. And I often have the students that I have in class who are education majors talk about, you know, what do you do about really difficult subjects like, you know, the Columbian genocide against Native American people? And my feeling is that, and I would say my professional belief is that we have an obligation to tell the truth to children of all ages. Now, there's certain level of age appropriateness about the level of detail. And like you say, the nuances. But so much of what you have to do in college is, you know, is iconoclasm. you know,
right?
She's show,
so
he's like
true.
telling people the truth for the first time,
Right.
about what happened in the past. And I just think that they should be told what's going on. And sometimes my kids, my daughter was asking me a question, and I responded at length, and she said, "All right, does everything have to be a lecture?" And it's like, so look, I know some things, and I'm going to tell you, and you're going to roll your eyes because you're a teenager, but
yeah,
you'll be grateful that you know it. Even if,
yeah.
like, not to build the bomb, but right, to know when your friend is building a bomb.
Hey,
right.
Exactly. Yeah, or some other kid who's not your friend, you know.
Yeah.
The bomb is for you, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And I'm laughing so hard at your daughter's response because I got that verbatim response from my child recently after one of my lectures. And, you know, yours are probably about history. Mine are about Star Wars.
Oh,
so,
right.
you know.
Now, come on, he should be primed to enjoy that.
No, he still doesn't want the lecture.
Yeah, but I definitely do think that, you know, you need to teach the dangerous subjects, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
you're acting like kids are living in a bubble. And of course, that's what Professor Umbridge wants to do. And we would not want to be like Professor Umbridge in any way, educationally,
yeah. right.
And pretend that dark arts are not a real thing that
right.
Students need to be prepared to deal with.
Good information is good. You know, like I remember
mm-hmm.
my doctor telling me that one time when she said, "Why don't we do this test?" I think I was pregnant at the time. And she was like, "Why don't we do this test?" And I was like, "I don't really know if I need that." You know, she was like, "You know,
mm-hmm.
knowledge is good. You know,
right.
if it's good information, it's good to have."
Right.
And I was like, "Okay, that sounds good." And I've been able to apply that many times over the years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're edging toward Gnosticism here, Emily. So
yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
But that fits me pretty well. So
yeah.
Well, we are joined today by Dr. John S. Nelson, professor of political theory and communication at the University of Iowa. He's the author of numerous books and articles connecting popular culture and film to political philosophy, one of which is the subject of our podcast today, his book called Defenses Against the Dark Arts, The Political Education of Harry Potter and His Friends. And that is from Lexington Books just last year, 2021. Welcome to the show, John.
Glad to be here.
So obviously we are interested in hearing everything that you can tell us about dark arts in the Harry Potter series. But tell us first, how did you encounter Harry Potter? And when did you start thinking about taking it seriously as a subject for academic study?
This is one of those questions that's answerable in 500 ways. The way I tell the story in your all's context is I got asked to direct the university's honors program for a while. And when I went over there, the first thing I learned from all the students was that they wanted to do Harry Potter stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a background in trying to do rhetorical things which start where the audience is. So starting where they were made a lot of sense to me. And I had enjoyed reading various things to my children, but I'm old enough that Harry Potter came along after that. And it was a great pleasure to return to that sort of situation. So as I was teaching over there, what I do in my teaching is to try to work with the students on whatever my current work is. So I took from them a cue that my current work should be about Harry Potter. And since what I focus on is politics, that was my inclination. But gosh, I think what I'm trying to point out to people in the book begins with the books themselves hit you over the head with the interest in politics that Harry Potter and his friends have.
Mm-hmm. Right. I totally agree with that. And, you know, what I love about it is maybe you don't see it so much in the first two or three books, but definitely by the fourth book, like you just can't. You can't escape the political apparatus around these stories that are really helping to forge the narrative. And then mm-hmm. when you look back at those earlier three, you realize that was there the whole time also.
Right.
And it's a terrific accomplishment to pull that off because, how to put this, I don't think that the politics hook would be so interesting to many of the people who are just beginning. And yet the quality of the books is such that virtually anybody who finds them interesting at all finds it very interesting to reread. And so you get into the politics, at least as you say, the second time around.
That's so true. You know, that's a big argument. I'm a big Star Wars person, as you may have heard. That's a big argument against the prequel movies, is that there's too much politics. You know, there's too much politics and it weighs it down. And I mean, you know, people who like politics can see past that. But you're right, it's a real you know, strength of the series that it kind of slides that in. So even people who aren't inclined toward politics find themselves very, very much wrapped up in it. John, one of your main arguments in the book is that there are a lot of different approaches to politics, you know, different approaches referenced in the Harry Potter books, including a variety of political styles. You even said in the book here, and I'm quoting, you said, "A glory of the Potter novels is their examination of the properties and possibilities of political styles neglected by our news and scholarship, especially political styles in the everyday lives of teens and young adults." So what are some of those styles, some of those approaches, and where do we see them in the wizarding world?
Oh, thank you for starting with that, because I had figured out that I was going to have to find some concise way to evoke that I'm interested in politics and everyday life. And how that surfaces for most of us is not in terms of ideologies as well-developed belief systems and sets of policy agendas and so on. It isn't even usually for most of us in terms of the kinds of political movements that we might encounter, like the sort of populism often attributed to Donald Trump and his followers. Mm-hmm. But it's just in how we interact with people on a daily basis. And the setting of the Potter stories in this classic British boarding school context is one in which that's taken to the hilt, so that we get presentations of most of the kinds of politics that you'd get in an introductory politics class at the college level.
Yeah, and I was really interested in the idea of political styles, which I hadn't really formulated that as a kind of way of thinking about politics in everyday life. But I think that we can totally see this in American politics today, that your political point of view can be communicated through your tastes and your cultural interactions and the way that you deal with your friends. And you're really interested in all of the ways that different characters are showing something about their politics on the basis of, you know, their ordinary interactions and the things that they like and don't like and the way that they talk about the very everyday things.
Yes, it shows up very much in their styles of thinking, so that the extent to which the books bring you inside the characters, especially the lead three, really helps in this regard. And so, how to say, from my standpoint, the books amount to not only a presentation in some respects, but a putting into play these different kinds of politics that are evoked by different characters at various points, and gives you a chance to feel your way through what works and what doesn't for you.
Right. And I think that's another reason why readers do find it to be not only relevant, but politically educational to them, because they can see the way they would like to be. They can try to understand how other people are by associating them with different Harry Potter characters.
You know, this shows up not only when I'm trying to teach an introductory course on politics, but also when I'm teaching almost anything else lately. I found that the one go-to move that's available in almost every course I teach is to ask at the beginning of the semester, how many of you know the Harry Potter movies or the Harry Potter books to some extent? And almost every hand will go up. And then from there on, when I need an example, sometimes I can draw one from the headlines and everybody will recognize it. But even more often, I can draw it from the Harry Potter books. And everybody follows along pretty much. So from that standpoint, they're just terrific at teaching people politics. But having said that, I want to throw in one more angle on this that relates to your asking me about how I started to take it seriously. For me, if I'm dealing with Star Wars or with Harry Potter or the like, part of the question is, what can I learn as a political theorist about our politics from dealing with this work? And that's a really good thing about the Harry Potter books, even though they do start out to be completely accessible to pretty small kids, they nonetheless are doing really interesting things. So by the time we get, for example, to that second book, Chamber of Secrets, which I think my first three or four times through, I regarded as the least successful of the bunch, mm-hmm. and probably also the least successful movie, I was starting to see that the part of me that had been working on Donald Trump and followers for some years, even before Donald Trump came on the scene in terms of trying to understand populism, was being treated in a way by the Potter books that my colleagues in professional political theory weren't doing. There was an appreciation of the importance of celebrity that shows up not only with regard mm-hmm. to Gilderoy Lockhart, but with the situation of Harry and with the situation of Dumbledore. Hmm. And it's really much more sophisticated than I had been to that point in thinking about how populism works. So that then when I get into some of the other kinds of politics as they appear in the Potter books, I'm also learning things I did not know before as somebody interested in various kinds of politicking.
Wow, that's really cool, right? Speaking to the mm-hmm. power of fiction and narrative to convey complexities that sometimes, like scholars, we could use a little prodding in that direction.
Well, and they not only convey the complexities, but even if the author doesn't have clearly in her mind that she wants to do X politically, which would often be the case with the Potter books, I'm sure, even then, when you're paying close attention to the settings and the institutions and the magical devices, and especially the characters, things happen in the story that make available to readers things that the author may or may not recognize. Mm-hmm. And from that standpoint, I've never felt very limited to authors' intentions about such things.
Mm, absolutely. I think we're in that camp as well, right, Emily?
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, and I was just thinking how this speaks to one of Tolkien's what he says are the functions of fantasy, mm-hmm. And that is, you know, recovering a different viewpoint, or sometimes it's going back to a previous viewpoint, but you know, it can be just acquiring a new viewpoint on something you've been staring at for years, you know, and to be able to give you fresh eyes on that. I think it sounds like what you're talking about, John.
Well, and the secondary creations that Tolkien made his mm-hmm. main goal, they do take on a life of their own, mm-hmm. right? Out beyond what even the author can intentionally construct. And that's one of the things that keeps the Tolkien stuff going and is going to keep the Potter stuff going.
Mm-hmm. Right. I totally agree with that. So one of the really interesting points that you make in your book, John, is that politics as like a general arena is both dark arts and also defense against the dark arts. So it's doing both of those things. It has both those possibilities. It's dark. It's got its dark elements and it's got its protections. What are some of the specific examples of that in the wizarding world?
Let me start with a definition for a minute that probably ought to be debated and even displaced eventually. But just to get started, I thought it was really important not to equate dark with evil. And when we hear dark arts, then we're inclined to think that people are doing awful things to other people. But to me, the way the Potter books read, the dark arts there are crafts for inflicting effects of one kind or another on other people. And of course, that doesn't have to be something that's evil. On the other hand, it's always open to the possibility of becoming evil, because you are overriding other people's intentions for themselves when mm-hmm. you do this. And it may be that what you do is something that turns out to be completely welcome, but when you're doing it, you're not necessarily in a position to know that. So then I'm sure the easy example is the Unforgivable Curses, which we're inclined to think with Barty Crouch Jr. teaching them especially are going to turn out to be irremediably evil through and through. And yet everybody notices by the end that you have Harry himself, as well as some of the other heroic characters in the book, let alone Dumbledore in particular, using all kinds of spells, including those. And they're good examples, again, of how I learned from the Potter books, little stuff. I had worked for years ago, back when I was in graduate school, on theories of totalitarian regimes and mm-hmm. how people like George Orwell or Carl Friedrich or Hannah Arendt were in the process of kind of making a mythos of totalitarianism to warn people that what's happening over there could happen here, and we better be alert to it, which, of course, in some important respects, is exactly what the Potter books are doing on many fronts. And in relationship to that, you get a sense of a totalitarian regime under an Adolf Hitler or Stalin or Lenin or Fidel Castro or somebody as a very hard-edged enterprise imposing things on people. Mm-hmm. And yet the Potter books want to start with the Imperius Curse. And does the Imperius Curse take you over in the mode of possession that's described by the Potter books? No. They calm and soothe you and make you not care to resist as you take the little hints and suggestions that urge you to do this or not do that, so that you're pretty much effectively puppeteered. And the way in which the likes of an Orwell or an Arendt would talk about totalitarian propaganda and ideology and the like needs that sense of the soothing and persuasive dynamics mm-hmm. of the regime operating on people, and doesn't usually get it. Now, on the other side, what both of them emphasize as the harder parts are in the Potter books too. You get way toward the sixth book, and you've got Draco Malfoy stomping on Harry's face at the beginning when he's caught him on the train.
Oh yeah, and that's a hard one to read.
Hard to read, but notice how it's an exact enactment of George Orwell having his spokesman O'Brien for the Big Brother regime in 1984 say, if you want to understand the regime of Big Brother, this totalitarian regime, picture a boot stamping forever on a human face.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly putting together not only the stuff that we got very used to, which would go on into the Cruciatus Curse and torture and so on down the line, but the stuff we wouldn't necessarily think of, and that Harry and Hermione and so on are able effectively to use an Imperius Curse, and Harry at least tries to use a Cruciatus Curse, and we think toward the end we're going to get a use that's justifiable of the killing curse, shows you that in many respects it is the uses of the particular arts, even though, yes, some arts are more conducive to some uses than our other arts and other uses, that makes them dark.
Yeah, I find that so interesting. Emily, how many times have we talked about unforgivable curses and like, what do we make of the fact that we have good characters using them?
Right, because he doesn't, you know, he succeeds in using Crucio, I think, against the Karos when they offend McGonagall.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, he's got it by then. And of course, he's used the Imperius Curse before that to break into Gringotts.
Right. And, you know, and the question, I think that this is a good context in which to put that question. When you think about, they're called unforgivable curses, of course, by the government. Right. And so, but if we take out the, you know, that word unforgivable, which is what the society is doing to try to control the way that you think about them and use them, and you think about them in this way that, John, you're telling us to, in terms of, you know, that there are these ways to assert influence and power over people, and, you know, they can be used for good and for bad. And Harry certainly thinks he's doing good when he gets back at the Karos for what they did or said to McGonagall, for example. And then he's trying to, you know, get the Sword of Gryffindor in Gringotts. And so it's a kind of means justifies ends, though, which we saw that that got Dumbledore into a lot of trouble as a young man, right? That he's doing it for the greater good. And this is ultimately be good for muggles to be ruled by wizards.
Well, the books pay a lot of attention to that dynamic, right? The arguments for and the arguments against ends justifying means. One of the things that stands out to me is the respect shown in what at least begins thoroughly as children's fantasy, however dark, for the way in which idealism is celebrated in these books. Nonetheless, realism is respected and even celebrated to some extent. And I think one of the things that lets that happen, which is another really smart thing in the books, is signaled by what you were talking about just a moment before with how the curses are branded pretty much governmentally as unforgivable curses, because there's this pervasive concern with forgiveness, how it can happen, how it can't, when it should, when it shouldn't, so on down the line throughout the Potter books. And it's no coincidence that when you go back to some of these theorists of totalitarianism and fascism and so on down the line, you find, as in Hannah Arendt, for example, a really huge concern with the same dynamics of forgiveness as an ingredient that are kind of missing from most of our modern ideological politics of liberalism, socialism, fascism, communism, conservatism, so on the line, the kind of theories there don't make room for a detailed consideration of forgiveness, but the Potter books do.
Absolutely. I mean, that's that pivotal climactic scene of the duel between Harry and Voldemort. It hinges on the question of remorse.
And I think back to people writing about Potter stuff, I think I've read more really excellent things about remorse and the way that the Potter books handle this than almost any other subject about the books.
Yeah. Right. And I do think I agree with you totally that having these books, it sort of encourages people to think more deeply about topics that they would maybe even consider peripheral, you know, to their everyday lives. Yeah. So you mentioned, John, realism and idealism, and you actually do talk about a lot of different kinds of political ideologies besides the ones that I think get a lot of attention. So, I mean, I think fascism and liberalism, totalitarianism, these get talked about a fair amount in people talking about the politics in Harry Potter. But you talk about realism, idealism. I was particularly interested also in perfectionism as a political style. And then also you talk about patronism. And I thought particularly you framed some big contests in the book, in your book, between perfectionism on the one hand and conformism on the other. And so how do you think the Potter series like shows these different ideologies and styles like facing off against each other, again, among these, mostly among the characters?
As a political theorist, the first couple times I was reading the Potter books, what stood out to me at the beginning was how the entire series is framed by the real first sentence, let alone first page, confrontation between the celebration of normality that goes along with the Dursleys' conformism on the one side and the encouragement to Harry to revel in and develop responsibly his magical powers, which goes in a perfectionist direction. In the book, I spend no doubt too much time trying to pull out of the words that are invented in various ways and the labels and kinds of magic that are presented, that what we've got going on here is, in philosophical terms and stylistic terms, what we'd call perfectionism. And by that, I mean a kind of tradition that arguably begins with American transcendentalists like Ralph Waldo Emerson, gets picked up and turned in various ways by Friedrich Nietzsche, but then surfaces again in somebody like the Harvard professor Stanley Cavell, and where we're used to regarding that as something that is connected with various kinds of German Nazi perversity, and Italian fascism and so on down the line. And that's a perfectly good set of connections to develop. It's also important to understand that there has been this more, if I can put it this way, American inflection available from the start of cultivating the sense of joy and love and forgiveness and the like that is connected with the Potter books. So in that regard, I want to talk about styles partly because nobody has ever made a perfectionist movement of note, and nobody has ever developed an ideology of perfectionism, unless we're going to count the kind of third millennium Aryan race kind of stuff as the perverse version of this stuff. And so it was really important that I have a way to talk about this kind of everyday life conduct that it seems to me is above all being celebrated in the Potter books. And it's a good thing for people whom I encounter often beginning their university educations to be encouraged to excel, but not excel in a competitive way with others, let alone a dominating way with others, but in some of the terms that involve discovering who you can be and what you can accomplish and so on down the line. So that's what I'm doing with the attention to magic as perfectionism, and Harry is the main exemplar of it. And it's important to see that that's set against not only conformism, but it's seen as a kind of development out beyond the idealism and realism that the books pay serious attention to, and even the existentialism that seems to me to dominate a lot of the literary reflections on the Potter books, where, you know, there's interest in the extreme emotions of when Harry's bored or when Harry, the emergent teenager, is angry and emotional and mercurial in his feelings and so on down the line. And there are all kinds of existentialist things in a sort of French vein that come up in this regard. But in addition to that, there is this kind of attempt to get beyond the repertoire of modern Western politics in terms of the main ideologies to something that is going to give you some way of responding effectively to dark times of fascism and perverse perfectionism in totalitarian regimes.
Right. And what I like is that you can see perfectionism in Harry, and then you see Dumbledore as kind of his mentor in that, right? Encouraging that more personal striving for excellence, but that Voldemort is actually doing perfectionism as well. And so again, you have perfectionism that can be used, you know, for good and for bad purposes.
And I think that's very much something important to the Potter books. They want to illustrate that. They do see the current dark times the way you all were adverting to them earlier in the conversation as something that we're not entirely likely to leave behind. The timeliness of these books is just kind of staggering unless you start stepping back and saying, gee, maybe they're getting at things sufficiently pervasive, if not basic, to our circumstances that we're not readily going to leave behind the troubles that the books are trying to deal with.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, I was thinking about as you were talking is this idea that, you know, maybe we didn't really even leave those things behind as we liked to pretend that we were doing in the sort of latter middle part of the 20th century, maybe. And one of the concluding thoughts that you have is actually about the epilogue, which we generally refer to as the much hated epilogue, although Emily and I are not haters, but
not by us.
You express some disappointment in the epilogue because it doesn't seem to take seriously the idea that the more negative uses of these arts are going to continue even after Voldemort has gone away, right? You have All Was Well, and it's 17 years later, and Harry's scar doesn't hurt anymore, right? And we've wrapped it all up in a nice little, as you point out, conformism kind of bow.
I think that's a nice way of expressing some of my personal reservations about it. And how to say, these give me hope with every further exercise in pottery. You know, when you get to the cursed child, I look to see if it's going to help with this, and I didn't feel that it did. I haven't seen performance, but I've read the script. And the same hope with regard to the Fantastic Beasts movies, where there's really an opportunity to do something, because the focus on the fascist versions of perverse perfectionism is so strong. But I don't know, given what happened to the casting problems and the financial returns with the third movie, I'm not sure but what that might prove to be it.
Right. Yeah. And we've talked a little bit about that, whether we'll see more, even whether we'll see any more movies at all. And then also, you know, like, is there a coherence to the story that they're telling about those earlier years, which I think it was just a great setting to pick. And I think people are really interested in that. And as you say, what a marvelous time to be able to, you know, really be able to follow through on that kind of perfectionist politics notion. But, you know, will we get that? I guess we'll have to stay tuned for that.
Well, right. Like the Potter fan that I am, I really liked the first two Fantastic Beasts movies. And I didn't think much of the third one. I just sort of thought casting Mads Mikkelsen as Grindelwald doesn't help at all. It's being in the shade of Johnny Depp, maybe. But one way or another, there's an opportunity there to do something. And with regard to the epilogue of the original seven books, I put it in terms of wondering why there isn't any discussion at all of some adjustments with regard to Slytherin House.
Right.
It seems like there's been so much attention to the troubles there that it's a disappointment that that's dropped in the end.
Right.
I totally agree with that. Absolutely agree. Right. There are no structural changes that come about as a result of this experience of not only Voldemort's rise, but his subsequent re-rising in Harry Potter's generation. And, you know, the idea that we're just going to carry on with business as usual, but maybe some different people in those roles. I agree that it doesn't quite hit the mark.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, even the fact that Albus Severus is terrified to be sorted into Slytherin in the epilogue, you know, and I think maybe, I don't know, some people would say the book deals with it in the sense that, you know, Harry gets down on his level and he assures him that there's bravery to be found in Slytherin as well. But just the fact, I mean, you know, so in that sense, I guess it's addressed, but it's pretty mild, you know, in terms of, you know, this kid is still terrified. So obviously these value, you know, the value that there are brave people in Slytherin too, that hasn't, you know, gotten through to him the way it needs to, you know, to make this situation okay, to make it okay for him to be sorted into whichever house he gets sorted into.
Well, I think you're right to focus on the reassurance coming in terms of bravery or courage, and the way that the books are all cast in terms of Gryffindor and its signal virtue probably encourages that. But having said that much, you can kind of tell from the way that I try to end what I'm writing about in terms of defenses against the dark arts, that I think there needs to be some way of helping the Slytherins, if I can put it this way, lighten up. And to me, that references a set of virtues that are not signally associated with Slytherin House that maybe ought to be explored a little bit more. It's not that the books don't explore them. It's that they explore them only with regard to how they can leaven, complement, etc., virtues like courage and steadfastness and so on down the line. But the Slytherin House project is the one that most readily says to everybody, hey, perfect yourself, right? Extend yourself. And that reaches off in the danger of various kinds of elitism and racism and so on down the line, just begs for some consideration of antidotes or countermeasures of one kind or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Just right on. I'm in sympathy with that.
Right. Right. John, I'm interested in this notion of the fool that you talk about late in the book. What is the fool in politics, and how does the fool, what roles does the fool play in the politics of the wizarding world?
Well, gosh, I find that hard to answer because, like the different kinds of politics, to me, there's so many different kinds of fools suited as complements to different kinds of politics that starting with one is fairly nebulous, but I recognize that you've got to do it. And in regard to that, what I'd say is that the fool is the one who in the Don Quixote mode, which is to say our little braggadocio knight that follows folks around from one picture to another, Sir Cadogan, that the notion is that we need to be able to see ourselves as ridiculous from time to time. And in that regard, the affection that especially Bill Weasley has for Sir Cadogan suggests that with the different kinds of politics, many of which have various things to be said for them, they're going to be needs to recognize not so much weaknesses as vulnerabilities, that you need to develop a capacity of criticism in relationship to them. And if you were going to put a political label on that kind of idea, I suppose above all, it would be a standard sort of liberal political idea. And I want to associate liberalism in these books with Albus Dumbledore above all. And it seems appropriate that the education that somebody's going to get at the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry is going to have a lot of ingredients that involve folly of one kind or another, not least of which is the way that Dumbledore himself not only makes mistakes and declares that he was foolish to have done so, but is presented as somebody who kind of is a little overfull of himself, right? And is dandyish in his dress and conduct and so on, and who knows it, but doesn't feel like that's a reason to not be who he enjoys being, does see it as a reason to appreciate the kind of limitations that are there, which is why, by extension to another complex of concerns, he is not going to become Minister of Magic.
Yeah, that's so, I always think that's one of the things we like a lot about Dumbledore is that he can make fun of himself a little bit, right? And that he enjoys
right,
all
he doesn't
these
take
candies.
Himself too seriously.
Right, right. And right, 10-pin bowling. So John, you point out that some of the fools that we can see in the wizarding world include Peeves, for example, and also the Weasley twins. So what political roles are those fools playing in the series?
They relate especially strongly to what I've come to regard, along with some sociologists and anthropologists, as a kind of tradition of folly. And going back in religious contexts, we can talk about things like Mardi Gras before Lent, and we can talk about the fool who is Pope for a day or King for a day, and connect it with the way in which a number of the traditional devices of folly don't just involve kidding around or trashing the truth, as with April Fool's Day or some such, but also with inverting societies, turning them upside down.
Mm-hmm.
I pay a lot of attention to how Potter magic is about turning and troping in the sense of figures of speech. And in relationship to this, that's what Peeves and the Weasley twins insistently do. And the thought about how this relates especially to resisting fascist moves, authoritarian moves, and the like, is that it turns you from a position of being dominated, being inferior, disadvantage, and jujitsu-like tries to turn that into advantages of one kind or another. And this is around all over the place in recent literature. The place I knew it best as a fan of science fiction was Harlan Ellison's Repent, Harlequin Said the TikTok Man, where the idea is you get a totalitarian situation, and here's a sort of jokester who is repeatedly sabotaging things and staging little happenings that make people chuckle, but also disrupt the efficient operation of oppression in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that in the fifth book, where you've got the Umbridge regime in Hogwarts as a kind of bureaucratic rehearsal for what Voldemort and company are trying to achieve later, you've got a situation in which that's what Peeves and the Weasleys do, right? And the specific connection with bureaucracy is emphasized by the way in which the Weasleys create their portable swamp, which has got to resonate to Americans thinking about the Donald Trump slogan to drain the swamp, et cetera, right? And so in one way or another, whether it's the teachers who are taking advantage of their newly truncated authority and capability to run ragged Umbridge, who now has to be summoned to deal with any little old problem that crops up, or it's a matter of producing everything as you got to go the long way around. You can't do anything directly and efficiently. Things are getting disrupted up and down and so on. What you've got is a tradition of folly that is fully political. And I try to suggest that in some respects, what folks in political theory could learn from this is that there's a kind of anarchism that's not been paid much attention to. People often talk mm-hmm. about an anarchism that's a complete absence of order, or they'll talk about it the way the fifth book does with the visit of Hagrid to the giants, where you've got a kind of state of nature condition and it's the biggest bully rules the roost, but only for a moment. You can't stay on top of the mountain for long, and life is, and Thomas Hobbes put it, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short as a result for the poor giants. But this notion of a chaotic anarchism is one that takes advantage of how you can produce, in the chaos mathematics sense, cascading events that can turn very small spaces for resistance into very effective campaigns that undo what a fascist regime is trying to accomplish.
Right. I love that idea that the folly itself is connected to a kind of maybe almost even like a healthy anarchism that prevents this stultifying bureaucratic disciplinary control so common to totalitarian regimes.
John, you argue that these books provide a political education, not only for Harry and his friends, but also for us readers who are both children and adults, especially in dark times. What lessons would you say we can gain from these books about how to live in the dark times that confront us now?
I begin with the sort of point that I want to include all of us among the friends of Harry. And so in that regard, what we can learn are the different kinds of politics that Harry has a chance to learn, and learn that even some of the ones that seem worst have aspects that we might need to know in order to defend ourselves against them.
Mm-hmm.
And that some of the best ones have these vulnerabilities or these dispositions that we better learn well in order to be wary of.
Absolutely.
And in relationship to that, over and over and over, I always summarize this for classes by beginning with the idea that for me, politics is a plural noun. We often use it in American English as though it's singular. There is this realm called politics. But for me, there are many kinds of politics. And that's one of the really wonderful things about the Potter books. They show us this in action.
Right. And I just want to point this out to our listeners, that you actually do go through and particularly talk about the political styles or ideologies that are represented by the different Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers. And you also make the point that they're not always the official teacher, right? Because sometimes there are these unofficial dark arts teachers that we are encountering.
Well, it seemed to me in the beginning that what I was getting in the books the first four or five times through, I'm really slow at this stuff, is that each offering of the dark arts was an education in one or two kinds of politics. Mm-hmm. And slowly you start figuring out that that's way too simple, that the series is far too developed and integrated and clever in that regard. So you do start spotting that they're unofficial dark arts teachers and that they're bringing something different to the fray and Song Dao line. You mentioned earlier, for example, the talk in my book about patronism or patronism.
Right.
Halfway invented the word. I don't even know how to pronounce it. The thought would be that what's going on in the sixth book when you get Horace Slughorn is that he becomes, effectively speaking, Harry's teacher of defenses against the dark arts, and that Potions mm-hmm. that year takes over for what's going on, since, because of the animus between them, Harry and Snape don't find it possible to learn directly from one another, right? Now, mm-hmm. of course, Harry is also learning by leaps and bounds from the old Snape notations in the margins of his textbook that, right. that Harry happens to come upon. And that's the other big way that he's instructed in that sixth book. And one of the nice things about this is that you don't get political theorists talking to classes about patrons and so on down the line. And yet again, if you've got people in the first year of college, one of the big things they need to notice about what they're there for and what's going on is the way that patron and patronage networks work, and how survival and advancement connections are a big part of what college is about, so that in their everyday lives, going to classes and various kinds of social functions and standing in the hall waiting to get into class and chatting with people, or staring at their phones instead, they are still in a position where the kind of networking that's going on there is treated in some intelligent detail.
Mm-hmm.
By this stuff. And, you know, it's so important that Dumbledore kind of takes Harry aside early, just after he's introduced him to Slughorn and used him to recruit Slughorn. And he points out the moves that Slughorn makes and what makes him an excellent collector of talent and so mm-hmm. on down the line. So that, again, we get a fairly well-developed, almost theoretical presentation of something that doesn't usually get much attention.
Right. And I love how you point out, yes, Slughorn in his patronage, it can sometimes seem very elitist, and Harry definitely doesn't have like a positive response to it initially. But you point out that like Harry also works through friendships, right? And helping his friends. And that's what patronism is. That's what it is to, you know, participate in a patronage system.
Yeah. And how to say, he's unintentionally the kind of hub of his right. network. And to me, it's a fascinating thing about the character to look at how he gradually comes upon an awareness of that dynamic and adjusts what he's doing in relationship to it, because there are a bunch of responsibilities in that regard and opportunities in that regard. And it's nice that he's got Dumbledore as a mentor, because Dumbledore, too, has been doing this very self-aware and mm-hmm. quite intentionally for years.
Right. I'm thinking about even his relationship with Dobby and how that, you know, comes to serve first Dobby, but then to serve Harry so thoroughly.
Oh, that's a terrific example. And in that regard, I like to assign to students that they read people like Malcolm Gladwell, who write in a more journalistic vein about the social sciences. And of course, his famous book, The Tipping Point, is full of talking about these dynamics of networking, where you've got people who are talent scouts. And in relationship to that, the examples that come out of Harry Potter are just ones that I'm going to add the Dobby case to, because I hadn't thought about extending it in the direction that goes.
Right. Well, and it's ironic because it's not a relationship that other people would value, you know? And so, you know, I think we have a similar theme that goes on in Star Wars with droids. You know, when people have a good relationship with a droid, you know, other people may dismiss that as unimportant, but it comes to serve, you know, the person who's willing to treat a droid like a friend, you know, instead of like a machine. So yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic. I'm always here for the Dobby references. So
well,
happy
you know,
to help.
What that makes me think about is if we're talking about the two main droids, C-3PO, you know, is given to us as one of these kinds of dandies who's a that sort of a fool. And it is important to be able to deal with somebody in a constructive and effective network of connections in that regard. And so it becomes important that Harry can learn to some extent to appreciate Slughorn, even though he does not like the dandyish interest that Slughorn has in all these little perquisites of being a Hogwarts professor and all the little pleasures that he has and his delight in name dropping and so on down the line. And yet, these are skills that Harry needs to acquire, at least as defenses against, if not themselves, dark arts.
For sure. You know, one of the points that you make, John, that I appreciate a lot is toward the beginning of the book, you talk about how, you know, one of the main things that you have to learn is that, you know, when do you need defenses against the dark arts? And it's, well, you have to just recognize the dark times that you're in. And it's like a turning toward the dark so that you can see them, so that you know to develop those defenses. And I thought that was a very important point that, you know, you can just let a lot of stuff blow over you. And if you're not paying attention, and when you start to pay attention is when you need the defense against the dark arts.
And, you know, your phrase I really liked there, because there's several steps involved that are emphatically important in the Potter books. You have to learn to recognize, to recognize that you're in a dark situation, a challenging time of some kind, troubling for action. But then you have to learn how to turn and face it. And there are several steps involved in this. And to a considerable extent, it seems to me that over and over in the Potter books, that's what's going on. Harry and his friends are learning how to recognize and then how to act on the recognition.
Right. And I would say, just to get back to circle around to an earlier point, I think the Harry Potter books have been very good at helping people to turn to the dark that we're experiencing. You know, it's really helped us to recognize the situation that we're in.
I really hope that's true. I mean, it's a pretty awful situation as best I can see. And it's not just in the United States, right? It's
right.
Pretty much worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's really nifty about the Potter books is that you get serious, detailed attention to fascism starting with the second book, much more than the first. And yet at the same time, you're getting serious, detailed attention to populism. And I started paying attention to populist politics completely apart from fascism, and have waited with dismay for my colleagues not to end up equating the two. I could show you any number of books where political theorists are basically arguing that populism is going to become fascism, or at least it's going to become authoritarian, almost without any doubt or hesitation. And how to say that puzzles me, because in the context of American politics, we have lots of kinds of populists that are easy to find, even in the electoral context, like Elizabeth Warren, who are not headed down any such trails. And if you're going to recognize and resist the darkness of the times that relate to those aspects of the Potter books, you're going to have to be able to figure out how there's some things to be said, even for Gilderoy Lockhart, that as much as he is a fool and he is full of himself and he is irritating as all get out, there are some things he really knows a lot about, including celebrity.
Right. He's always given Harry lessons.
That's right.
Yep. And charms. Memory charms, especially.
Yeah. He's too good at those.
Well, gosh, John, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about defenses against the dark arts.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Wow, it's been great to have you. And I feel like even, you know, I loved reading your book, and also this conversation has also been very informative on top of that. Listeners, you will definitely want a copy of the book, Defenses Against the Dark Arts, and it, I think, will be out in paperback as of mid-September this year, 2022. It is definitely going on my shelf. I have it pre-ordered already. For the closing quote today, we turn to a man who both dabbled in dark arts and practiced sophisticated defense against them, although, of course, he only served as defense against the dark arts teacher for 1 year, as they all seem to do. In this case, this is Severus Snape. I think you'll recognize some themes that we've brought up in our conversation in this quote. Snape said, "The dark arts are many, varied, ever-changing, and eternal. Fighting them is like fighting a many-headed monster, which, each time a neck is severed, sprouts a head even fiercer and cleverer than before. You are fighting that which is unfixed, mutating, indestructible. Your defenses must therefore be as flexible and inventive as the arts you seek to undo."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Stay ever vigilant, listeners. Until next time, class dismissed.